Welcome to the Deep Dive.
It's good to be here.
So today we are undertaking a really critical deep dive into a profoundly moving and, well, complex history, the German Jewish identity.
And this wasn't just, a physical history of migration.
Yeah.
It was an intense, decades-long intellectual and spiritual negotiation with modernity itself. We're going to be following the structural arguments laid out by Paul Mendes-Flohr, which really guide us through the concepts German Jews built to define their own lives.
And we have to start by recognizing that this identity, it wasn't just dual. It was defined by this central, very potent metaphor, one that thinkers like Franz Rosenzweig and Martin Buber use.
That's right. They conceptualized the German Jewish reality as a Zweistromland.
That's Zweistromland. So
Yeah.
literally a land of two rivers, like Mesopotamia.
Exactly. And that image is so powerful. It suggests an identity that's nourished by two mighty continuous flows, not just one.
So on one side, you have the powerful deep current of the Jewish spiritual heritage.
The covenant, the history of Israel, all of that. And on the other, you have the vibrant intellectual flow of German culture, especially the ideals of German humanism.
So our mission for this deep dive is to understand how German Jews tried to harmonize these two streams, or at least, strategically coexist with this twofold spiritual patrimony.
And not just historically, but conceptually, we're looking at the models they propose for living with multiple, often conflicting identities.
And to anchor this whole discussion, we have to start with a quote. It's from the cultural critic Gustav Landauer in 1913. And it just tells you immediately this story is about complexity, not compromise. He said, "I accept my complexity and hope to be even more many-sided than I am now aware of."
That statement is, it's revolutionary in this context. He is fundamentally rejecting the monolithic demands of nationalism or total assimilation.
He's not just accepting complexity, he's actively seeking more of it.
Exactly. He's positioning the German Jewish experience not as a flaw or a problem to be solved, but as a paradigm for modern plurality. It's this embrace of the lack of artificial unity.
But the shadow of tragedy, it fell over this complexity almost immediately. To really get the stakes, we have to acknowledge the arc of this history, which the poet Heinrich Heine seemed to foreshadow decades before the catastrophe. Let's look at this chilling anecdote from his 1834 novella, Leaves from the Memoirs of Herr von Schnabelwopsky.
It's a moment of truly grim prophecy. So Heine describes this Jewish student, Simson, who, in a tragicomic attempt to defend the biblical idea of God against an agnostic, is mortally wounded in a duel.
Right. And Simpson, who is small and feeble, is carried back to his room.
And on his deathbed, he asks for the story of his biblical namesake, the ancient Samson, to be read to him.
And the reader gets to that passage where the original Samson, blinded, betrayed by the Philistines, decides to pull down the pillars of the temple.
Declaring, "Let my soul die with the
And
Philistine."
little Simpson, in his fever, he grasps the posts of his own bed and tries to shake them, mumbling that same curse.
"Let my soul die with the Philistines." But the posts, which kind of symbolize the unyielding reality of the modern world he tried to enter, they remain immovably fixed.
He just collapses back onto his pillows.
With a melancholy smile, and a stream of blood oozes
A
out.
melancholy smile. It's so powerful because it just captures the doomed nature of the struggle. He has the ancestral spirit, the defiance of Samson.
But the pillars of the modern German structure are simply too strong to shake.
He wants his soul to die fighting, but his spiritual heritage is just defeated by this immovable modernity that refused to accept him fully.
It is the earliest, and you could argue the grimmest, capture of the German Jewry's predicament. It foreshadows the apocalyptic reality, this desperate desire to maintain ancestral loyalty while fully embracing a culture that ultimately refused to allow that duality to stand.
Okay, so let's unpack this structural tension, this bifurcated soul. We have to start with the very specific sociological terms German Jews use to understand their own situation. This distinction between assimilated in the accusative and assimilated in the dative.
This framing, which comes from the liberal rabbi Benno Jacob in 1927, is absolutely fundamental.
So a quick grammar lesson. The accusative case receives the action.
Exactly. So German Jews were assimilated in the accusative because they received or took on German cultural values, language, knowledge. They mastered Goethe, they mastered Kant, they culturally absorbed Germany.
But the dative case, that implies a destination, assimilation into society. And that's where it all broke down.
That is precisely where the failure occurred. They were not assimilated in the native. They absorbed the culture, but they were never fully accepted socially, politically, or genetically by the majority society.
So their acculturation was, as the source says, fundamentally differentiated.
Which meant they were structurally forced to live with plural identities. It fractured their loyalties and made them, in the eyes of observers like Gerson D. Cohen, a perfect mirror of modernity.
A mirror of modernity. What does that mean?
It means they were living the future. The future of plural, complex identities, while the rest of Germany was trying to cling to a monolithic past.
And this challenge was made so much worse by Germany's unique political development. Until 1871, Germany was a belated nation. It didn't have a cohesive political state.
Right.
So how did Germans even define who belonged? This leads us to the critical tension between Volk and Bilding.
So German identity was coded by two competing criteria. First, you have Volk. This was the holistic, primordial community, a definition based on, you know, shared genealogy, ethnic heritage, historical myths.
A spiritual connection to the German landscape. It's an ethnic criterion.
Basically. It's inherently closed and rooted in ancient, often mystical history. And the problem is obvious.
The Volk ideal excluded Jews automatically, no matter how acculturated they were.
Precisely. Which pushed Jews overwhelmingly toward the second definition, Bildung.
And Bildung is what?
Bildung was the enlightened ideal of self-cultivation, moral refinement, and the mastery of universal philosophical values. You achieved it through education, through engagement with high culture. It was the cultural criterion.
And they believed that if they mastered German high culture, they would earn their place.
They had to believe that. This is where you get that famous quip, calling themselves Germans by the grace of Goethe. Deutsche von Goethes Gnaden.
That line always has such an ironic edge to it.
It's deeply ironic. They are proudly proclaiming their Germanness based on the grace of the cultural heroes they revered, which just confirms that their identity was earned through cultural effort, not granted by birthright. This reliance on Bildung became their entire strategy for inclusion.
And we can see the intensity of this strategy and the truly jarring disproportionate statistics relating to the Bildungsbürgertum.
The educated middle class.
Right. And you have to define that term for us because it's more than just being an academic.
No, the Bildungsbürgertum was a uniquely German social stratum. It was not just professors and writers, but the consumers and producers of high culture. Lawyers, doctors, prosperous merchants who filled the opera houses, subscribed to literary magazines, and maintained these rigorous intellectual standards in their homes.
And Jews rushed into this class.
They rushed in not just for economic status, but for respectability, for cultural acceptance. They saw it as the only viable path to becoming genuinely German.
And the numbers that illustrate this rush?
Yeah.
They're shocking. You have to just sit with them for a moment.
They're incredible. The commitment was total. By 1860, Jewish male children in Prussia were attending secondary schools, the gymnasia, which were the pipeline to the university, at 3 to 4 times the rate of non-Jewish children.
3 to 4 times. I mean, you have to think about the pressure in those households. Education wasn't a luxury.
It was existential self-defense.
Which makes the university numbers just staggering.
Yeah.
In the late 19th century in Prussia, for every 100,000 males, what were the figures?
It was 33 Catholics and 58 Protestants studying at universities.
Right.
Compared to 519 Jews.
519. That's almost a 10-to-1 ratio compared to Protestants. How did that not breed immense resentment?
Oh, it absolutely bred profound resentment. And that high visibility meant that even when they were fully assimilated in the accusative, they were still seen as separate.
Right.
Theodor Fontane, a hugely respected German writer, he captures this discomfort in his 1894 poem, On My 75th Birthday.
What does he say?
Well, while celebrating the congratulations he received, he pointedly noted that those celebrating him had very, very different names. Myers, Pollux, Abram, Isaac, Israel.
Wow. So he's acknowledging their intense devotion to German high culture.
Yeah.
They're the ones celebrated the great German writer. But he's simultaneously pointing out that they aren't really German.
Precisely. They were the most passionate patrons, the most dedicated consumers of Bildung. Yet their separate identity was marked and highlighted by the very culture they adored. It just underscored the heartbreaking realization that their profound commitment was never going to be enough to transcend the ethnic demands of the Volk.
Because initially, the ideal of Bildung was supposed to be this unifying cosmopolitan force.
Yes.
It promised a neutral society where your historical background was irrelevant. That was the whole promise of the Enlightenment.
But that liberal cosmopolitan dream was very short-lived in Germany. As the state consolidated after 1871, social and political forces increasingly constrained Bildung. The educated class became, conscripted into state service and the bureaucracy, the military, the universities.
So the ideals of self-cultivation were redefined by parochial national consideration.
Right. Bildung went from being a universal passport to being a national uniform.
That's a great way to put it.
And the sources point out this tragic irony. German Jews remained the last guardians of the original German idea of Bildung. They clung desperately to the liberal, universal, cosmopolitan image of German culture, even as the German mainstream had moved on.
Moved on to embrace an ethnic nationalism that defines citizenship, not by Kantian ideals, but by ancestry.
Which takes us right back to the roots of the problem, with the Mendelssohn paradox and what the source calls the crucial political mismeeting.
Right. Moses Mendelssohn. He was supposed to be the model, the first German Jew.
The great Vorbild.
Yet his contemporaries found him incomprehensible. Why? Because he was not one person, but two.
Mendelssohn was revolutionary because he successfully integrated high German philosophy into his life while remaining a fully observant Jew. He tried to reconcile these streams in his key work, Jerusalem, in 1783.
And his argument was what?
He argued that Jewish identity rested on two pillars, historical truths and revealed ceremonial laws, a distinctive, separate way of life. He demonstrated that Judaism was rational and totally compatible with the Enlightenment, but only if the state maintained a strict neutrality regarding religious practice.
So he assumed the state would act as a neutral arbiter, prioritizing individual civil rights.
He did. He assumed the Enlightenment would bring about the contractual state model, like in France or North America, where your ethnic or religious origins are irrelevant to your citizenship.
But German intellectuals and politicians, tragically, went in a completely different direction.
A catastrophically different direction.
And the response from German thinkers like J.G. Fichte in 1793 was just radical exclusion. I mean, that quote is horrific. He demanded that Jews could only deserve equal rights if one were to
chop off their heads and replace them with new ones, in which there would not be one single Jewish idea.
It's the intellectual precursor to total rejection.
Fichte was articulating this profound, visceral fear of a state within a state. And this is the political mismeeting, the massive gulf between Jewish expectation and German reality, while Jews believed in the contractual state.
Germans developed the state as principally serving a Volksnation.
A cultural nation, grounded not in law and universal ethics, but in shared ethnic genealogy and historical memory. And that model was fundamentally, by design, exclusionary to outsiders.
So the Jews bet their entire future on a philosophical model of the state that Germany was simply not building.
They completely misjudged the core mechanism of German identity. And this foundational conflict, it reaches its political climax with the historian Heinrich von Treitschke in 1879.
Right. The man who famously popularized the slogan, "The Jews are our misfortune."
Treitschke's attack focused on history. He argued that Jews lacked a historical sense regarding German antiquity and that they preferred the, quote, rootless modernism of France.
He saw their intellectual dominance in the press and finance as a kind of cultural disease because they weren't rooted in German history.
But here's the central bitter contradiction in his argument. Treitschke simultaneously chastised the Jews for clinging obstinately to their own distinct national identity and historical memories.
It's an impossible double bind.
Completely. He wanted them to forget their history, to embrace his, but then accuse them of not appreciating his history enough.
So they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't.
His demand was absolutely uncompromising. On German soil, there is no room for dual nationality, Doppelnationality. The very duality, the Zweistromland, that German Jews sought to master was declared impossible by the prevailing German intellectual authority. That's the structural nightmare of their identity.
So facing this deep-seated structural exclusion, German Jewry responded by turning Bildung into something. Something spiritual, what the sources call a cult of Kultur.
Yes, the veneration was total. For many, it replaced traditional Jewish study. They internalized this idea that culture, not just piety, was sacred.
Which is why Goethe's writings were standard bar mitzvah gifts.
And why they passionately read Kant and Schiller. They were performing a spiritual act by consuming high German culture, seeking the universal truth that the Volk had denied them.
And you see this elevated status in the intellectual connections they tried to make. Hermann Cohen, for example, arguing that Kant's ethical idealism wasn't just compatible with Judaism.
He claimed it was the philosophical expression of ethical monotheism. Cohen basically made Pont into German Jewry's prophet. He was trying to create a seamless link between the German humanistic tradition and the Jewish ethical heritage.
And their affection for figures like Lessing.
Enormous. He was the author of Nathan the Wise. Jewish leaders actually funded his monument in the 1880s because Lessing embodied that promise of tolerance and universal ethics, a promise they were desperate to keep alive.
Let's revisit the statistical reality of their success, their Parnassus, to understand the sheer magnitude of this investment.
The quip, Doctor ist ein jüdischer Vorname. Doctor is a Jewish first name, is, you know, a piece of dark humor, but it captures the social reality.
As we noted, the university attendance rates were astronomical.
In Vienna in 1890, over a third of the entire university student body was Jewish. This wasn't just intellectual curiosity. It was a socioeconomic strategy fueled by what Einstein observed, that they had been preparing for entrance exams for two millennia. It was about securing status and respectability in a society defined by educational attainment.
Now, the sources outline three structural affinities between classical Judaism and German Bildung that made this intellectual leap feel so natural.
Right. These affinities explain why the transition felt almost inevitable.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, both traditions place an intrinsic, almost sacred value on education grounded in canonical texts. For Jews, it was the Talmud. For Germans, the classical canon Goethe, Schiller, and so on.
And the second?
Second, both share an anti-eudaimonistic view of knowledge, which means knowledge is pursued for the sake of truth and ethical illumination, not just for earthly happiness or practical gain.
So study is an ethical imperative, not just a career path.
Exactly. And third, both uphold a rigorous ethical idealism, the belief that philosophy and knowledge must illuminate what one ought to do in service of the good.
So these alignments meant that the German university, in its ideal form, felt like an extension of the traditional Jewish academy.
A new vehicle for ancient values. That's right.
But despite these affinities and this immense success, the psychic cost was enormous. The sources point to a psychic imbalance fueled by internalized negative stereotypes of Judaism as unmodern or anachronistic.
This internalization often led to self-doubt, fragmentation, even self-hatred. They were dedicated to a German culture that was simultaneously teaching them their own heritage was outdated.
Franz Kafka just nailed this existential trap in a letter.
He really did. He described acculturated Jews as being stuck, writing that with their hind legs, they were still glued to their father's Jewishness, and with their waving front legs, they found no new ground.
They were perpetually in transit, unable to advance fully or retreat comfortably.
That image is devastating. And this inherent problem with the Enlightenment's offer is perfectly illustrated by the changing perception of Lessing's Nathan the Wise.
For early German Jewry, it was their spiritual Magna Carta.
But later thinkers saw the fundamental flaw in Nathan's wise tolerance. Rosenzweig argued that Nathan was a disembodied Jew, a character totally abstracted from the concrete reality of Judaism. The Enlightenment's model of tolerance demanded that religious differences be relegated to sentiment and personal taste. It basically said, be religious in private, but in public, just be pure humans.
And the price of becoming a pure human is that you have to sacrifice your concrete identity. You lose the specific, meaningful reality of being Jewish.
Exactly. Rosenzweig pointed out the structural implication of the play. At the end, there are no children. There are no Jewish, Muslim, or Christian descendants, only abstract, pure human beings. The promise of tolerance was conditional. You can join us, but you have to agree to eventually dissolve your distinct tradition.
Mendelssohn himself, years earlier, had sensed this danger. He rarely criticized Lessing, but he did question Lessing's view of history as progressive.
Mendelssohn was wary because the idea of history as a progressive scale inevitably fostered a pernicious tendency to differentiate peoples by moral development. And, you know, guess which culture always ended up lower on the scale? Mendelssohn countered this by upholding the permanence of natural law, eternal verities accessible to all people at all times, rejecting a historical trajectory that rendered traditional Judaism obsolete.
Yet the pressure to prove Judaism's relevance led to the founding of the Wissenschaft des Judentums, the science of Judaism, in 1819. This was meant to counter the dominant Hegelian view that Judaism's contribution essentially ended with the Bible.
The Wissenschaft project was a monumental act of scholarship designed to demonstrate the intellectual vitality of post-biblical Jewish culture. But it was born with this tragic internal concession.
What was that?
Founders like Moritz Steinschneider aimed only to give Judaism a decent burial, its deeds eulogized and cataloged. They conceded that it was no longer necessary as a distinct living culture in the cosmopolitan age. Edward Gans, another founder, infamously argued, "To merge is not to perish."
That's a profound intellectual surrender.
It was. They were surrendering to the idea that Judaism was now only valuable as historical memory, not as a future cultural generator.
This tragic arc just makes the anecdote of the Jüdisch Kulturbund in 1933 all the more powerful.
It is the ultimate act of defiant affirmation. So in October 1933, the Nazis established the Kulturbund to restrict Jewish cultural life to only Jewish audiences.
A ghetto for culture.
Essentially. And in response, what do German Jews choose to inaugurate their theatrical program with? Lessing's Nathan the Wise.
They were holding up the liberal, humanistic promise of Germany in the very face of its fascist negation.
And they made a crucial, deliberate change to the staging. In Lessing's original, Nathan exits aglow, embraced by this new universal brotherhood.
But not in 1933.
No. In the 1933 Kulturbund production, Nathan stayed behind, proud and lonely at the front of the stage as the curtain fell. That lone figure affirming the German humanistic tradition that rejected him, that represents the deepest inner reality of German Jewry.
This brings us back to the idea of the mastery of the admixture, which thinkers like Gustav Landauer and Martin Buber championed.
Right. Landauer accepted complexity and rejected artificial unity. And Buber, confronting the rise of nationalism, agreed. He called the modern Jew a cultural admixture and said it would be inane to try and expel one part.
So the challenge wasn't to eliminate the tension.
But to become masters of the admixture, to control the mixture, not be controlled by it.
And Rabbi Leo Baeck exemplified this personal mastery during the darkest years.
His daily spiritual discipline is just a perfect metaphor for this ideal. Before the Third Reich, he would read a page of the Talmud and then a passage from a Greek play in the original. As things got worse, he changed his routine.
What did he change it to?
He would read the Hebrew prophets, affirming the ancestral source, and then the German classics, Kant, Goethe, Schiller. He was demonstrating that the duality was a source of necessary spiritual strength, affirming both traditions against the backdrop of total destruction.
So part three of this story deals with the peak of this intellectual success, the German-Jewish Parnassus, and the inevitable collision that came with it. Thorstein Veblen celebrated the intellectual preeminence of Jews in modern Europe in 1919.
But Veblen's celebration comes with Gershom Scholem's devastating retrospective. He said, "It was precisely their preeminence that was to spend the doom of the Jews of Germany."
Success itself became a liability.
It was perceived as infiltration and domination of the cultural sphere, a direct challenge to the folk's supposed cultural superiority.
And this resentment was there long before 1919. Edward Gans, who was Hegel's star student, felt it early on. He lamented being hated because it is uneducated, and persecuted because it tries to educate itself.
The problem was the timing and the speed of their ascent. German society was not accustomed to or comfortable with the rapid, disproportionate success of an outsider group, particularly one they had defined historically as culturally inferior.
And this hidden resentment finally just broke into the open in 1912 with the Moritz Goldstein article.
A crucial moment. Goldstein, a Jewish scholar, publishes the German-Jewish Parnassus in the journal Der Kunstfahrt, and he just breaks the code of silence.
What was his core assertion?
It was blunt and totally unprecedented. He wrote, "We Jews are administrating the spiritual property of a nation which denies our right and our ability to do so." He claimed Jews were the cultural custodians of Germany, running the press, the theater, the music halls, while the nation itself rejected them ethnically.
He forced a confrontation with this hypocrisy.
He did. And the reaction from the journal's editor, Ferdinand Avenarius, was astonishingly candid.
And Avenarius was Richard Wagner's nephew, which adds a whole other layer of significance.
It does. And Avenarius essentially endorsed Goldstein's observation. He listed the specific areas of Jewish intellectual dominance, but then attributed this power to Jewish wealth, injecting that toxic stereotype right into the conversation.
But Goldstein's goal wasn't to gloat.
No, his goal was to challenge the complacency of his fellow Literatenjuden who pretended their separateness wasn't recognized.
And his personal dilemma just captures the whole Zweistromland tension. He felt completely German-raised on German fairy tales, understood the streams and forests, but the Volk called him totally un-German.
He was a German patriot by culture, yet racially suspect. His article forced the question, "If we are administering your spiritual property, why won't you let us in?"
This raw intellectual tension drove the next generation of thought. Most importantly, in the correspondence between Walter Benjamin and Ludwig Strauss in 1912 and 1913.
Strauss was seeking a Jewish national reawakening, reacting against the perceived emptiness of total assimilation. But Benjamin's response is fascinating.
He agreed they were bifurcated, Zweiseitig Jewish and German.
But he said the Jewish side had only an exotic or sentimental aroma. It lacked substance. So Benjamin rejected political or cultural Zionism for Western Jews. His vision was a Zionism of the spirit.
A Zionism of the spirit. What does that mean?
He argued the German Jews' specific, maybe unique mission was to be the most eminent bearer and representative of matters spiritual and intellectual. They should form an elite in the party of intellectuals. Their job was to advance internationalism and critical inquiry, not to build a separate culture.
This leads to the very challenging concept of the esoteric Jew. If Jews are to be the critical intellectual elite, what is the role of Judaism itself?
For Benjamin, Judaism had to remain thoroughly esoteric, a vague, understood Gesinnung, a disposition or spiritual orientation. He was afraid that if Judaism became explicit or systematized or organized into a cultural or state entity, that rationalization would deaden what was vital and creative about it.
So the Jewish contribution was critical energy, intellectual fire that shouldn't be domesticated into a manageable culture.
Exactly. And he illustrates this with his parable of the reverse Tower of Babel.
Right. Tell us that.
In the biblical Tower of Babel, the people built from the ground up, trying to reach heaven with stone and mortar, but they failed because they lacked spiritual will. Modern Jewish intellectuals, Benjamin argues, are doing the reverse. They wield ideas as building blocks, build from above without ever reaching the ground.
They operate solely on the level of soaring ideas, but they're detached from Ursprung, from origin, from material tradition, from the Jewish historical earth they abandoned.
They have all the spiritual architecture, but no foundation.
It's a devastating image.
And this intellectual restlessness fueled the post-assimilatory shift that exploded after World War I. Martin Buber's journal, launched in 1916, was named Der Jude, the Jew.
That choice of title was revolutionary.
It was a massive, defiant act of pride trotz Judentum. Just a generation earlier, that word was avoided in polite, cultured German circles. Now, Buber and his generation embraced it explicitly.
And this resurgence was, as the scholar Shulamit Volkov argues, a dialectical spin-off of successful assimilation.
Yes. The new generation, free from the anxiety of proving their Germanness, stopped at the brink of total absorption and turned inward, seeking a vigorous new Jewish definition for themselves.
And finally, we have to revisit Hermann Cohen, whose pre-war work attempted to define an ideal Germany Deutschtum und Judentum based on a parity between German patriotism and Jewish religion.
Cohen fundamentally believed that German Jews felt as secure in our German patriotism as in our Jewish religion. He saw Jewish messianism and German humanism as destined partners.
But it's essential to understand that Cohen's construct was fiercely Kantian.
Yes. He was disclosing what Germany ought to become, grounded in its ethical heritage, not describing the jingoistic, imperialistic Germany of World War I.
He was building an ideal framework in the face of empirical collapse.
He was. And he used his platform defiantly, warning Germany against nationalism, urging it to return to Kant and Goethe. His defiance was formalized during the infamous Judensalung, the census of Jews in the military, designed to check accusations of disloyalty.
And what did he do?
Cohen affirmed the Jews' right to their religious inheritance, asserting his hope that Germany would one day be proud of having paved the way for the attainment of a spiritual harmony between German and Jew. He held fast to the ideal, even as the empirical reality was failing all around him.
This intense intellectual struggle really culminates in the work of Franz Rosenzweig, who represents the intellectual pinnacle of the Jewish Renaissance. His life, moving from contemplating conversion back to a profound, living Judaism, serves as the perfect eulogy for German Jewry.
Right. Rosenzweig died in 1929, before the worst of the Nazi era, which allowed his profound synthesis to stand as a testament to what might have been. And his family history is the entire story in miniature. It illustrates the spiritual debt of the grandchildren.
Let's trace that lineage. It included the Maharal of Prague, a towering spiritual figure.
But his great-grandfather, Samuel Meyer Ehrenberg, pioneered modern secular Jewish education. He prioritized building.
And this shift created the classic German-Jewish family tension. The full fallout was evident in his cousin, Rudolf Ehrenberg, who was half Christian, half Jew. He had heirlooms from both the Maharal and Martin Luther's bride.
Rudy felt like a spiritual déclassé, heir to neither tradition comfortably. He was stranded by the assimilationist project.
And this spiritual homecoming, this debt to tradition, was crystallized at Franz's wedding in 1920 with Rudi Ehrenberg's famous toast.
It's an incredible moment. Rudi used the family goblet, a physical token of Jewish tradition, passed down through centuries in his coast. He contrasted their fathers, who only looked forward to assimilation, with his generation, the grandchildren, who were finally looking back to reclaim their tradition.
And his reinterpretation of the goblet is the ultimate metaphor for the Zweistromland.
It is. The Jewish goblet represented the enduring form, the integrity of the tradition itself. This goblet, he said, must be filled with German wine, the ever-changing living culture of the surrounding world. He was celebrating Franz's return, acknowledging that the challenge was to drink the culture, the wine, without the vessel breaking or the contents corrupting the form.
But wait a minute. If the form is fixed tradition and the content is ever-changing culture, isn't there an inherent risk that the German wine eventually just dissolves the Jewish goblet entirely? That seems to be exactly what assimilation tried to do. How did Rosenzweig protect the integrity of the form?
That is the core question Rosenzweig sought to answer, and it brings us to his most critical philosophical achievement, the dialectics of the and that links Judentum and Deutschtum. He wanted to define the correct relationship between these two flows.
So he analyzed the failures of the previous attempts at synthesis.
Yes. He looked at Mendelssohn, and for him, the and was separative, a weak linkage. Judaism, the revealed law, and culture, rational truth, were kept strictly distinct. This made Judaism safe from rationalization, but it left the Jew disembodied, having to search for culture outside the tradition.
Okay, and then there was Hermann Cohen. For him, the and was harmonizing a direct partnership, an equation.
Rosenzweig dismissed this as a self-deceiving fantasy. Cohen, living during the nationalism of World War I, had to factor out all the uncomfortable empirical realities of Germany, the ethnic hatred, the jingoism, to create an idealized Kantian Deutschtum that he didn't actually share.
Rosenzweig called this intellectual manipulation infinite chutzpah.
He did. Cohen manufactured a harmony that ignored the real tension.
Rosenzweig's vision, therefore, was revolutionary. The and must be tension denoting, a creative tension.
He argued the tension is only a problem if you take both components seriously. It required an emphatic, compelling and where neither side diminishes the other. This led him to redefine Judaism itself.
He said it's not essentially a culture like German culture is.
Precisely. Judaism attests to revealed meta-historical, meta-cultural truths. Israel, the Jewish people, is born apart from culture. It's a uniquely meta-historical community living in sacred time.
But individual Jews have to live a dual destiny.
Right. They're denizens of this meta-historical reality and participating citizens of the Umwelt, the surrounding world environment, the culture. The function of the and is to preserve the integrity of this tension, to allow the individual Jew to fully participate in both without one dissolving the other.
That is a demanding model. What was the practical path to achieving this living reality?
The task of the Jewish Renaissance was to restore Jewish vitality, to make that Jewish goblet strong again without severing involvement in world culture. And Rosenzweig created the model for it, the Lehr House, the Free Jewish House of Study in Frankfurt in 1920.
And this wasn't a traditional school or a seminary.
No. It was dedicated to serious, non-doctrinal Jewish adult study. It tacitly respected the participants' German culture while providing the opportunity to know Judaism as Judaism, encountered as an autonomous living reality, not just a cultural contribution to the West. It allowed the individual the freedom to choose their own way of living with the and.
His personal affirmation, even as he was dying, seems to encapsulate this difficult, powerful realization.
His final conclusion was, "I believe my return to Judaism has not made me a worse but a better German." He affirmed that while tearing him into two pieces would mean he would not survive, his heart would ultimately go with Judaism. He recognized that the life of divided passions was not a comfortable compromise, but
a beloved danger.
Eine geliebte Gefährdung, a danger that must be embraced with love. The danger is what makes it vital.
So this deep dive from the pathetic struggle of Simpson against immovable pillars all the way to Rosenzweig's vision of a vital, tense duality shows us that the German-Jewish experience redefined identity not as fusion, but as the mastery of a complex admixture.
And critically, we have to avoid the fallacy of retrospective judgment. We can't condemn them for failing to predict the Holocaust. We have to judge them on the depth of their intellectual and philosophical struggle. The German-Jewish symbiosis was less about a successful partnership with Germany.
And more about an inner Jewish dialogue.
Exactly. A heroic attempt to synthesize two powerful, often contradictory sources of selfhood in the modern world.
We have to return to Kafka's sardonic gloss, acknowledging the empirical difficulty of this tightrope walk. Am I a circus acrobat riding astride two horses? Sadly, I am not. Rather, I lie flat on my back.
That was the pain of the attempt. And yet, the final defiant act of the Kulturbund staging Nathan the Wise under the Nazis reflected the deepest inner reality, that the cosmopolitan humanistic tradition of Germany was, in a profound sense, their own and worth affirming even as the German state rejected it.
The ultimate inheritance they left is not just a history of brilliance and suffering, but a universal challenge for all modern people navigating multiple cultural spheres. It's the challenge that Elias Canetti, a German-speaking Jew, poses, reflecting that Zweistromland sensibility.
He asked, "Can't I still belong to all of them, as before, and nevertheless be a Jew?"
That question, how to maintain primordial integrity, the integrity of your own truth, while simultaneously belonging to the whole world and its changing culture, is the legacy of German Jewry. They embrace that demanding life as a beloved danger.
So for you, the listener, as you navigate your own professional, cultural, or personal spheres, the legacy demands you consider. What is the beloved danger you choose to embrace?